All right, I thought I would start out by doing a bit of review and talk about contract in general, and then go on to the family law stuff that we're doing for this week. To begin with, are there questions any of you have, not on family law yet, but on the contract that we spent last week doing? All right. Very brief review of what we did, that you design contracts, if you're sensible, to minimize problems of breach, as well as to maximize the, more generally, to maximize the joint benefit to the parties to the contract. You are especially concerned with eliminating risk of breach if the contract is not enforceable, but even if it is enforceable, you'd rather stay out of court if you can. The obvious way to avoid breach is to avoid writing a contract in such a way that there will be situations where one party gains a lot by breaching. And if you can't avoid that, if given the way situations change during the period of the contract, try to set it up so that if somebody is going to have an incentive to breach, it's whichever person is most constrained by reputation not to breach. So if you've got to trust anybody, trust the repeat player, essentially. Among the possible rules for dealing with breach, assuming that rules are enforceable, expectation damages give you the right incentive whether to breach, because they say, like a good Pigouvian tax, that if you breach, you must pay the cost you've imposed on the other party, making as well off as you hadn't breached. However, they give too much incentive to rely if the other party might breach, because if the other party might breach, the other party breaches, he's going to have to compensate you for your reliance expenditures, and thus you will make them even if allowing for the chance of breach. Do you follow that argument? Yes, no, I can't tell. Yes?
What is it again?
Why expectation damages give you the wrong incentive to rely. Do you understand what I mean by reliance?
Like, in the contract.
Yep. Anybody tell me what reliance means?
Reliance, I guess, is well, before the other parties perform on their part of the contract, you make preparations, spend out money to prepare to fill your side of the contract.
Right. Basically, doing things which are worth doing if the other party is going to abide by the contract, but not worth doing if he won't, so you're relying on his abiding on the contract. And the argument is that whether you ought to do that depends on how likely he is to breach. And that if you have a case where it's a little bit cheaper to fulfill your contract if you make some reliance expenditures, but on the other hand, if the contract breaks down, that'll lose you a lot of money, then if there's a significant chance of it breaking down, you shouldn't rely. All right, from an economic efficiency standpoint. But if the legal rule is expectation damages, then you know that if you make your reliance expenditures, if the contract doesn't break down, it pays, and if the contract does break down, it still pays because the other party has to make you as well off as if the contract hadn't broken down. All right? So that means that you have too much incentive to rely and thus will sometimes rely when you shouldn't. Okay? So it's efficient one of the issues that hopefully you'll get more aware of as the course goes on is the problem that often a single legal rule affects incentives on multiple margins. Incentive whether to do this or that, whether to do that or that, and so forth. So expectation damages rule affects both the incentive of the parties as to whether to breach, where it gets it right, but also the incentive as to whether to rely, where it gets it wrong. Liquidated damages, which is specifying in advance the amount of damages, get reliance right, because if I spend money on reliance and then the other party breaches, I'll get some money from them, but the amount of money I get won't be increased by having spent money on reliance, and I've spent that money. All right, so I still have the right incentive to count to allow for the chance of breach in deciding whether to rely. If the liquidated damages are set equal to the damage done, equal to what expectation damages would have been, then they give me the right incentive to breach. The only problem is that they're being set in advance, only they may not know how much a compensation will be. The other two extreme alternatives are either no penalty at all or specific performance, which are basically a property right in one direction or the other. Either one party has the property right that says he doesn't have to perform, or the other one has the property right that says the other one does have to perform. In principle, either of those will give you the efficient outcome via negotiation between the parties, but the it's a bilateral monopoly negotiation, it may or may not actually do that. Other ways in which you design the contract, you'd like, where possible, to put costs on the party which can either control or predict them in order to minimize moral hazard and adverse selection problems. And one way is a rule that you see showing up in both imperial Chinese law and actually in traditional Jewish law, which is linking ownership to control, so that while the property is in my hands, it's mine, and it's only when I've handed it over to you that it becomes yours, as opposed to fancier versions where it's still in my warehouse where you bought it. Freedom of contract, the basic argument in favor of freedom of contract is that the two parties want to maximize their gains, and as long as they're not hurting anybody else, the contract to maximize their gains maximizes the world's gains. And the arguments against freedom of contract, one of them is that the parties might be incompetent to recognize their own interests, either because they're crazy or children, or just that the court, for what its own reasons, concludes they must, somebody must have been stupid to sign such a contract. Second rule reason might be that the court doesn't agree with the objectives of the parties. I think you could plausibly describe the refusal to permit polygamy in the U.S., for example, as a case might say it's because they believe that any woman who agrees to be a second wife must have been acting irrationally. I don't think that's too plausible, but they may believe that. But a different way is that the legislature or the courts somehow think of polygamy as immoral, and therefore, even if you want to do a little thing. And finally, there's the argument of third party effects. So my contract is to hire you to kill him won't be enforced by the court, neither will my price fixing contract by which I and three other firms in my industry agree to hold on prices. I talked a bit about duress. Probably the most interesting case is real duress. That's, you know, your money or your life and the equivalent, where I argue that contrary to the obvious intuition, enforcing contracts made under duress was not always a bad thing, that there was a trade-off between the advantage, given the duress that happened, of letting people, in effect, bargain out of it by contract, and the disadvantage of making it more attractive to impose duress on people, because you could then get enforceable contracts. The example of the mother who takes a check, and I gave us examples where it was at least plausible that the advantage of enforcing the contract was more than the disadvantage. Parole rules in England prior to the 18th century, and the case of immunizing dictators who were kind enough to resign from prosecution for things they had done while they were dictators. And I then talked a little bit about form contract, which I argue were not a relevant sort of duress, and about the sinking ship case, which again is interesting for some of the reasons that I'm not going to go through again. I talked a little bit about the question of interpreting a contract, where the basic argument, which seems to me right, is that one strong reason why courts should interpret a contract by their best guess about what the parties would have specified if they had resolved the unclear parts is that that reduces the cost of making contracts because the parties don't have to defend themselves by putting in all sorts of fine print to cover unlikely events for fear that the court will do the wrong thing. One question that I think I did discuss in class, although it's in the chapter, is the issue of forming contracts, and in particular the case of the one-sided contract, the Lost Cat case, where which was supposed to discuss this somewhere, where the argument is, if I post a reward for finding my cat, you bring back the cat without knowing it's a reward, am I obligated to pay you? Sort of traditional meetings of the mind sense of contract, the answer is no. Posner wants to argue that the real question is not some metaphysical question of meeting of the mind, but only is it a good thing that such things be enforceable? He wants to judge it essentially by consequences. He then says mistakenly, whether Carol's writing or Carol's thinking, I don't know, that the issue is whether more lost cats will be brought back and so forth. And the answer to that, well, that's sort of an interesting question, is that doesn't tell us what we should have it, because what we really want in economist language is to know what the producer and consumer surplus from the bringing back of lost cats will be. Is that language too opaque to people? That is to say, finding lost cats is costly, or call somebody wandering around the neighborhood saying meow, 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 or putting up some food and checking his back door every half an hour, or doing various other things. The greater the incentive to find the cat, the more resources will be devoted to finding cats. And the appropriate criterion is the net gain, that is the value of finding some additional cats minus the cost of the additional efforts that goes into that. If you're thinking about what the effect of making the contract enforceable is, like many of these things, it has effects in both directions, so you don't really know. On the one hand, making it enforceable means that if I see a lost cat and I haven't seen a reward sign, I will say to myself, I really have something else to do. Maybe I should go away and leave this cat. I don't really know it's a lost cat. And maybe it's just a cat that lives outside. But it might be that it's a lost cat and there's a reward, and if there is, I'll get the reward. So why don't I pick up the cat and see if its tag has got a phone number, and call the number, and maybe I'll get some money. That effect will tend to result in people looking harder to find cats. On the other hand, the person who's putting up the reward, the knowledge that he'll have to pay if the cat is brought back, whether or not the finder knew about the reward, is an incentive not to put up the reward because it raises the average cost of posting a reward, and that will tend to result in fewer rewards. So you could imagine going either. Right, see?
Are you
guys
there?
Yes.
Right.
Anyway. So, I think that covers everything I wanted to say on that chapter. So, if none of you have any questions, we'll go on to talk about the rest of your lives. For many of you, it'll involve marriage and family and kids and that stuff like that. So, maybe you can get on with that. So, questions on this chapter before I start talking? Yes?
I have a question about, you talked about the concept of birth and welfare. And
yes.
I've heard that argument before, and a lot of people. Negative reaction, I think. What you put is interesting. I'm just kind of curious to help me visualize it. Would it be fair to say that there would be somebody who, regardless of the amount of money, they would get from welfare, would have children? On the other end of the spectrum, there's somebody who, regardless of the amount of money, welfare, they would not have children.
Right.
And it seems that there's some sort of line between that.
You know, putting it differently, what struck me some time ago, probably after I wrote the book, actually, though, in online discussions, was that a lot of people assumed that economics was the unicausal model. So they were saying, what you're saying is women have babies in order to be able to. And that's wrong, of course. What we're saying is there are costs and benefits to having a baby out of wedlock. The big benefit is the baby. I'm particularly aware of this because day before yesterday I visited my son and daughter-in-law and got my baby fixed because they've got a granddaughter who's very cutest baby in the world at the moment. She smiles a whole lot. She's whatever, she's 7 months old or something, produced via the market, as I may have told you, in a hired womb with her parents' egg and sperm out of this country. And she's a really cute baby. And I can certainly imagine quite a lot of people who were in a position where they say, you know, I have nothing of importance in this world, nobody cares very much about me, I'm not doing anything, wouldn't it be wonderful to have somebody who I love, who would love me, who would make me feel warm and useful and happy, and I could lie down on my back with a baby sitting here, lying here, which is sort of exactly what fills that particular emotional niche, then come with me. I can certainly see that. And I can also see that person saying, but if I do that, I'm going to be hungry and I'm going to be cold and I'm going to have a very hard time of it and I'm not going to be able to make much money because the baby takes a lot of time and effort and how will I feed the baby and how will I feed me? So even though I really want a baby, I'm not going to have one. Hope I can find a man who will marry me and support babies if not, I'll just do without. But if the law changes and the law says we'll give you not enough money to make you very comfortable, enough money to make it tolerable at least, then you have a baby. So you think of it as a multi-causal system. There's a list of costs. There's a list of benefits. There is somebody for whom, without welfare, the costs add up to a little bit more than the benefits. Throw in one more benefit and you simply have one. And that's the way to think in general. That is, about anything. That economics is not only about money, and certainly no economist worth his salt would say people will always take the highest paid job. Because obviously jobs have a whole bunch of relevant characteristics in additional But you would say that if you raise the wage for a job, we expect that people willing to take it will go up. It's not just the same thing. Some people, you know, the example I was giving in class this afternoon in my other class was, imagine as an attorney, you've got a choice between 8 hours a day, 5 days a week, doing work you really value for only $50,000 a year, working for an innocent project, saving innocent people. Or you could make $80,000 a year, working 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, trying to make partner in a law firm which specializes in defending people you think shouldn't be defended. Very likely you prefer the former, even though the latter pays more. But push the former down to $20,000, push the latter up to $150,000, you might change your mind. And if you might not, somebody else would. So that's sort of the general argument about what's going on in all these cases. Other questions about the chapter? All right. So the first question, and the one which people mostly don't ask but ought to, is why marriage exists. And there have certainly been people for at least the last century and probably longer than that who said it shouldn't, the sort of free love movement of the late 19th century, where somebody's comment on free love is the trouble with free love is it's neither. Meaning, roughly speaking, I'm not sure it was a movement for sexual promiscuity, but certainly for sex outside of marriage beyond the degree to which it wasn't considered acceptable at the time, although it certainly happened. And you could say they won, because certainly we live in a world where very few people think it's a terrible thing that people have sex outside of marriage. But it does push down the why we have marriage at all. You could certainly imagine a variety of other potential arrangements. You could imagine a society where women have children and perhaps the fathers help support them but don't live with the women, or even where it's, you know, everything is one night stands and the woman has a baby, she raises a baby. Well, that's her choice kind of thing. And you could imagine a variety of other systems. You could imagine a society where the normal rule was essentially something like our marriage until the child reached some age at which it was no longer a heavy burden. Marriage ends, go find somebody else and so forth. I've seen it argued that in hunter-gatherer societies, you often get patterns or something like that. The June Carbone used to teach here, that was sort of, some of that stuff was stuff she was professionally interested in, I gather. There was some evidence that the time in a marriage when divorce became most likely roughly corresponded to the time when hunter-gatherer couples tended to break up as the child was weaned and no longer required so much attention. Anyway, so you can imagine a variety of other things. Why do we have this pattern in which the normal arrangement for bringing up children and a bunch of other stuff is a man and a woman commit to a long-term partnership in which they typically share income, share property, have some division of tasks to be done, run a household, bring up children. And in a lot of societies, though certainly by no means all of them, that was normally assumed to be a lifetime arrangement. So why is that the case? What are the reasons why it was done that way? And if you figured out reasons why it was done that way, that then suggests reasons why it's less often done that way now. Comments? Questions? You've read the chapters, so you know my answers to that. But you were so confident that the first thing you think they're wrong. And my basic answer is that long-term contracts are mainly solutions to problems of relationship-specific investments or relationship-specific sunk costs. You understand the idea of sunk costs? Common term in economics. It's a cost you have incurred which can be productive under some circumstances, but you can't get back. So imagine that you've decided to be a cab driver in New York City, and GPS is happening to that again. And so you spend 6 months memorizing the map of New York City in such a way that if somebody tells you he wants to go somewhere, you'll know how to take it. That 6 months' time and effort is a cost. Why did you do it? Because you expect to get a return on it. It's an investment. You're going to be driving a cab. You can make, you think, a good living or better living than your alternatives driving a cab if you afford this cost. If, however, for some reason you decide not to be a cab driver, you fall in love with a woman who lives in San Francisco and you got to move there to marry her, you've suddenly wiped out that asset. The asset you bought with your 6 months is, unlike if you bought a car, That's a cost too, but it's not a sunk cost. You can sell the car when you leave. But the information just disappears. And the same thing would be true if you imagine that a firm invests money on designing a new tablet computer. At about the time they're ready to start actually producing the thing, Apple brings out the iPad. It's clear the iPad is better than what they're going to bring. They're not going to make any money selling it. Write it off. That's a sunk cost. And economics of sunk costs. Sunk costs generate what economists call quasi-rents, in the sense that you've gotten this information on how to drive cabs. You will now, thereafter, you expect to get a higher return than the normal return for your labor, because if you didn't, it wouldn't have been worth making the initial investment. And somebody wants to compete with you. If most people with your level of skill are earning $10 an hour, you're earning $12 an hour, you might think someone else would say, well, I'm earning 10, I should go drive a cab and earn 12, but he then realized that after spending 6 months learning the city first, not worth it, so he doesn't. So that's an effective life barrier. The quasi rent is the extra $2 an hour that you're getting as the return on your investment. And it's sort of like a rent, because like the return on land, you've now got a fixed resource to be used for something, but it's not literally. As I may have told you, one of my examples of Stigler's law, which is that scientific laws are never named after their inventor, is that Ricardian rents are called Ricardian rents because they were invented by Thomas Malthus. And Marshallian quasi-rents are called Marshallian quasi-rents because they were invented by David Ricardo. And that's only a slight exaggeration. It's basically true. It's a footnote in one of David Ricardo's
books. Yeah, that's a question about the sunk cost then. Because my understanding of sunk cost is more from a business standpoint than an economic standpoint, is that when you're making a decision going forward, you ignore the sunk cost, right? Because that's right. Your tax example, you know, some other, you know, you find some wood and you think about moving to Chicago, whatever. Choices are move to Chicago, go with fair benefits from that, compared to the benefits of going to New York.
But putting it differently, the benefits from driving a cab are an extra $2 an hour.
Right, with the quality rents. But
you've already made
the time spent in the 6 months doesn't really factor in.
That's right.
Whereas in this case,
because you can't get it back, right?
So in the case of a marriage, would like the sunk costs be relevant? Would they have to be sunk costs that then incur some sort of benefit on the other party that makes it more?
No benefit on you.
Okay.
Benefit on you. The benefit, see, it is much easier and pleasanter to live with somebody if you've figured out how to live with that person. Right? I was just discussing the subject with my 17-year-old son this morning, that it is clear that the thing I do that most irritates my wife is being insufficiently tidy in the kitchen. Specifically the kitchen. She's at least as bad as I am about letting papers pile up in the bedroom and not answering the mail for 6 months and stuff like that. But the kitchen is her working area. I do some cooking, and there are continual minor irritations because I've done something in the kitchen and haven't cleaned it up to her standards. Recognizing that, and therefore coming closer to doing what you would want than I would have 20 years ago, makes the marriage pleasanter for me as well as for her. Similarly, she has presumably figured out various things along similar lines about me, such as that I am not free to be interrupted on all circumstances, and that she's got to be somewhat sensitive. Am I sitting in front of the computer doing nothing of importance, or am I concentrating on writing a paragraph and I really don't want to talk to you now? And picking up on that kind of thing is, again, a useful skill, which makes it better for both of us. But from my standpoint, learning how to live with her is a sunk cost. From her standpoint, learning how to live with me is a sunk cost.
So then I guess in the decision then to,
whether it's getting married or not.
So it's so much, is it more the quality of rents from the benefit that you get from staying compared to
the quality of rents I get from staying, which will disappear if I
leave. Okay. Right.
So, but if you go back to our contract cases, that if you think about an ordinary contract where both parties are performing sort of not perfectly in sync and one of them might breach, part of the problem with one of them breaching is the other one's costs are sunk. If it were a situation where at the point when you breach the contract, I could say, zip, push a button, undo it all, I get back everything I spent designing that thing that you now aren't going to buy, then there wouldn't be a problem. Then we could just do everything on spot price. Well, market, as it were. But it's because long-term relationships involve varying costs that are only valuable if we continue with the relationship, that it makes sense. I ran the example I ran through was my slightly UCLA bargaining, which was an imaginary story. Not engaged in that bargaining. The only time I wrote that I had it was, in fact, at UCLA. I mean, gone there from the other side of the country. But the basic point is that whatever I spent learning skills that were particularly useful if I was going to be a professor of economics at UCLA would evaporate if I went somewhere else. So it was an asset, but an asset that was a relationship to such an asset that was only valuable as long as that relationship. And ditto in the other direction, you know, whatever the experts would mean, in effect. So then the argument that I'm making is that in the case of marriage, as other long-term contracts, part of the reason for long-term contract is that once you've made your relationship with Pacific Sun Cost, you're locked into a bilateral monopoly. There's a bargaining range that there is, if you imagine for a marriage, terms more favorable to the husband and more favorable to the wife, there's some range within that in which neither of them would walk out, but there's the potential to fight over where in that range they end up. And one possible way of dealing with that is to eliminate the threat of walking out, which either of them could use to try to force the other one to accept the terms that one preferred, by having essentially an unbreakable permanent contract, or at least hard to break contract. Another solution in the general case is the one we've really been talking about in the previous week, having a contract which specifies what each of us will do. So then you bargained over, you guaranteed me you would provide me with CPUs that ran at 3 megahertz. If you don't do it, you're in breach and you owe me money. And that would be sort of an example of that kind of situation. And there are problems with both those solutions. That if you have the permanent contract, you can't threaten to breach it, or rather you can't threaten to pull out of it, but you can breach it in the sense of not living up to the implied or actual terms of the contract. That's the point of my story of Maltanuki, which is I've got a sort of small collection of medieval Islamic law and economic stories, which I find useful and entertaining and informative, and the one about the vizier who accidentally gives 200 dinar instead of 200 dirham, dinar being gold coins and dirham silver coins, to a woman who asks for alms. Then the woman's husband complains that now the woman's too rich, thinks she's too rich for him and is going to force him to divorce her. And then the puzzle is, how can he force him to divorce her, given that women can't divorce men under Islamic law? I think, by the way, I was just rereading a paper that one of my students did on Shia Islamic law last year. And if she's got it right, a woman in that system can force a divorce if she's willing to give up essentially her dowry, her claim for money from her husband for terms of marriage. And in Jewish law, which has a good deal in common with Islamic law, historically, initially a wife couldn't force a divorce. Later, the wife could get the court to order the husband to divorce her, although she still couldn't divorce him. But anyway, in any of these cases, the argument, I think implicit in that story, though it never explains it, of course, is the idea that the way the woman forces the husband to divorce her is by just doing a very bad job of being the wife, by burning the food and nagging him all the time, and you don't know what else, whatever other things, so make him unhappy, and therefore you'll have to divorce him. So that raises the problem. To some extent, one solution to that problem, but a rather costly solution, is to have well-defined gender roles, which is to say, everybody knows that a good wife does A, B, and C, and a good husband does D, E, and F, and if you don't do those things, we probably can't take you to court, but the neighbors will think badly of you, and your parents will tell you how badly you're acting, and so forth and so on. You'll lose status. That's one possible solution. And I think that's a noticeable part of the traditional solution. But that has the obvious problem that you're then locked into some externally prescribed terms for your contract, which might not be the right term for you. It might be that in your particular case, the husband ought to be cooking dinner, and the wife ought to be, you know, fixing the house. I'm actually thinking of it. Particular couple I knew fairly well, where the wife, I think she did some sort of house construction professionally. It was obvious that if something was broken in the house, she was the person, the husband, to fix it. Whereas traditionally, I think of that as one of the male roles, as it were. And of lifetime contract arrangement has this real problem if you married the wrong person, which is one of the things that caused pressure for liberalizing divorce laws in the U.S. over the last century. So one solution is have a lifetime contract, well-defined roles. Another is Coasean solution. You have a lifetime contract, but you bargain within that contract, and hopefully you realize that, yes, I could be a real SOB about this, since they all keep messing up your kitchen unless you always cook the foods I like and never the ones you like and whatever else I want, but we're going to be together for another 30 years. Do I really want to start that, given the long-run consequences of that kind of relationship? So that's a solution. A different solution is to have divorce for cause. And the problem with divorce for cause is one we've talked about in contract before, that you can only enforce terms that are externally observable. So divorce for cause is causes adultery. That works to the extent that you can prove that adultery happened. But if divorce for cause is she's a nag, it's really much harder to enforce that. Or she's always belittling me, or he pays no attention to me and leaves the kitchen a mess, and so you can see that solution to the problem has serious problems. All solutions have serious problems, which is probably what makes marriage an interesting case for thinking about. Yeah.
I personally think that there should be some causal, even if it's just nagging.
Somewhat.
There should be divorce. Like, California has a no causal. Like, all I gotta say is didn't reconcile
right
differences. And that's that.
Yes, that's right.
And so it seems that it is very unilateral. Only one party seems to have irreconcilable
differences. Absolutely.
And then that's cause for divorce, which, like you said, can be beneficial to one party or the other, especially with community property laws being what they are, mm-hmm. at 50-50.
Yep.
One person can just get bored and say, well, I can make $400 million from this divorce, let's do it. So, I mean, and that's where I see.
But none of the solutions work. Because the alternative is for cause, and then how the devil do you prove most of the interesting causes? Because notice that, imagine you have a situation where if there were divorce on demand, I'd want to divorce my wife. As it happens, I don't want to. I did very well in that particular transaction, but if I did, then what I now want to do is to make it unpleasant for her in whatever way won't be observable to an external court. Right? Well, it's hard to keep you from doing that. And so you end up with a situation where you end up with a divorce by joint consent because she agreed, so that given the way I'm behaving, she'd rather not be married to me. I mean, that's one of the potential problems the other way. And, of course, another solution, which certainly has existed, is divorce with a penalty. So you say it's divorce on demand, but I then owe you alimony, or I've got it. They're a fairly common traditional system that you see in both the Jewish and the Islamic, certainly the Jewish, is there is some sum of money which maybe is contributed by both the husband and the wife's parents initially, something like that, which during the marriage is under the husband's control, but is ultimately the property of the wife. And therefore, the ketubah is the term in Jewish law. So if the husband divorces his wife, he's got to give her her ketubah, and if it's a substantial amount, that's incentive not to divorce. But then, at least the Shia Muslim rule that I was just reading about, and I think maybe the Jewish, I'm not sure, but it is that if the wife demands a divorce, she can get the divorce at the cost of giving up her that money, so the husband makes things very unpleasant, so the wife will demand a divorce. So all of these, I mean, it does strike me as the kind of situation where there isn't any really satisfactory solution given the nature of the problem. Each that you can always, it's like I remember my father's comment about the problem of monopoly, that there are really three alternatives to monopoly: private unregulated monopoly, private regulated monopoly, and government-run monopoly. That people who are familiar with private monopoly believe that the best solution is either regulated monopoly or government monopoly. People who are familiar with regulated monopoly believe the best solution is either private monopoly or government monopoly. And people who are familiar with government monopoly believe the best solution is either private monopoly or private regulated monopoly. That whichever one you know about is the one you're against, because it doesn't work. marriage exists in the present form. And there are obviously other features that left out, in particular, the fact that there are economies of scale. That, you know, it's as easy to cook for two as for one, that children are children of two people, and so we can both get the benefit of having the delight of little kids around if we're living together, both the parents and the kids, and so forth. But I think the sort of long-term contracting nature is really because two can live as cheaply as one as roommates as well as husband and wife. That doesn't require a long-term contract. And so it's I think the sunk cost element explains the long-term contract. And then the question is, why is it that things have changed? Why have we moved to a regime of more or less divorce on demand from a regime before that of divorce for cause and before that pretty nearly of no divorce at all, which I think is basically the Catholic position, which was the position in England until Henry VIII decided to divorce. And one answer could be that the reason is some sort of ideological change. You could certainly, and I suspect most people do believe that, if you sort of ask the random person at this school why divorce is easier, it would probably be something like, we've come to understand the rights of women, or we come to reject the traditional idea of gender roles, or something vaguely along those lines. But an alternative, and to my standpoint, more interesting and perhaps even more plausible explanation, is that it was changes which changed the costs and benefits associated with long-term contracting and marriage. And I would argue that the main change occurred from the woman's side and consisted of the fact that being a wife for most women went from being a full-time to being a part-time job. That it was a full, the two big changes. One of them was the drop in infant mortality, the fact that you did not need to produce as many children. Producing children is moderately costly unless you have the good luck to be one of the women who pregnancy is really easy, and bringing up infants takes quite a lot. It's not clear that bringing up children need take as much work as they can spend on it. There's an economist called Brian Kaplan who has a book arguing people should have more children, unpopular position, and part of his argument is that we greatly overestimate how much our attention to our children affects how they turn out, and therefore overestimate how much we have to sacrifice of our own in order to do a respectful job of bringing children. But in any case, but it's always going to be quite a lot of work to have kids. Rewarding work, in my view. In fact, I was just talking to Eugene Meyer, who was the head of the Federalist Society, and who I have known since he was 11 or something, for various reasons. And he got married late in life and had a kid, and he said that before they decided to have a kid, he asked all of his married friends what they could tell him about having kids. And he said, they all gave me the same two answers. And he asked me, and I said, yes, it's a lot of work, and it's worth it. And those are basically the two answers. He agrees now, I think it's 5 or something at this point. Anyway, that was at a conference a week or so ago. He happened to be there. Anyway, so where was I? Right. So it's a lot less work than it used to be, both because they're having half as many or a third as many kids. And the second part is increasing division of labor means that there's a lot less household production. Somewhere, have any of you ever heard anything by Dorothy Sayers? Ever heard of Lord Peter Wimsey? She was an English detective novelist. Lord Peter Wimsey was her detective. And I think you might have seen television shows of it or something. But he was one of the well-known ones. And maybe the best novelist, certainly one of the best novelists in the detective genre, as opposed to just writing thrillers. But she was also an interesting lady in lots of other ways. I think she was one of the first women to go to Oxford, for example, back around 1900, or at least part of the first couple of classes. And she has an interesting essay where she's responding to men who object to women stealing men's jobs, as women going out in the labor force and doing jobs, as the men are saying, we wouldn't have had otherwise. She says, well, look, I'll make a deal with you. You can have the men's jobs as long as you're willing to give up back to us the women's jobs. And that includes essentially all of the textile industry, all of the food preserving industry, all of the child rearing industry, all of the things which until the last century or two were traditionally done by wives in the house rather than in factories by companies. And I thought it was a nice point, actually, before I opened it, but it was also just a nice point of reminding us that that's one of the ways in which the world has changed. And it keeps changing. That my, I may be wrong, but my guess is that my wife and I eat out. I'm sure it's true that my wife and I eat out much more often than my parents did when I was growing up. That when I was growing up, the normal pattern was probably that my mother cooked dinner for us 7 days of the week. And once in a while we went out. Whereas our pattern, I suppose, is that my wife or I, usually my wife, cooks dinner about 4 nights a week, and we go out about 3 or maybe 5 and 2, I'm not sure. And my impression of what I've seen is that we're having dinner at home more often than the average, not fewer. So that's a case where one of the remaining bits of household production, namely cooking in the house, is still, I think, gradually sliding from the household to the market. Well, the more that stuff slides from the household to the market, the less the sunk costs, the relationship specific sunk costs of being married. It doesn't really matter if your wife knows how to cook the things you like. She's going out to the restaurant. Anyway, you can go out to that restaurant with your next wife, too. And similarly for the rest of the stuff. Well, if the woman is less specialized in being married, that means that the costs to her of breaking up the marriage are lower than they used to be, since there are still costs to not being able to break it up that we've already discussed. That means that you're going to shift, have pressure to shift towards easier divorce, more people choosing to get divorced, however easy it is. So I think that's at least a plausible economic explanation of that particular rather large change. The next bit is, I think in the book, at least what I was going to talk about, is the argument that comes out of I thought quite an interesting article by Lloyd Cohen, who's another friend of mine, who I think has perverse rhetorical tastes, because he wrote an article that should have made him popular with feminists and made him unpopular with feminists purely because of his choice of language. That what he said was that women depreciated faster than men, and apparently feminists don't. Whereas what he should have said, which was exactly the same statement, was in the traditional marriage arrangement, women perform their share of the contract early and then perform their share of the contract late, and thus the men, by reneging on the deal, can in effect walk away with the best years of my life. Since his title was, part of his title was, I gave him the best years of my life, but then in the text of the thing, he put it in terms of depreciation. Both statements are true. That I think it's pretty clear that the relative marriageability of a 40-year-old woman versus a 20-year-old woman is much lower than of a 40-year-old man versus a 20-year-old man. And if you go back to sort of traditional environments, part of the reason is the 20-year-old woman can still produce lots of children and the 40-year-old woman can't. But if you go back to just people's feelings, part of the reason is that men find younger women more attractive. One of the reasons to marry a woman is to sleep with her. Only reason, maybe not even the most important reason. But in any case, the net result is, as Lloyd says, but whichever language you use to put it, that opens up the opportunity for opportunistic reach for the man who dumps his wife as she's getting older, picks up a younger and prettier wife at a point when he's making more money than when he married her than the first wife, and therefore is a more attractive husband than when the husband is contributing his income, and that creates a problem. And then, as Lloyd pointed out, the world doesn't freeze. People then adjust to that situation. And how do women adjust to knowing they're at risk of being dumped under those circumstances? What are the obvious things to do?
They adjust to not being dumped. How do they perform?
Right.
I guess I think you might have said this, but I don't know if that's exactly what you meant. Kind of expand out and spread out. In the way I look at it, rather than trying to bust out 4 children in 6 years, have a child here, wait 4 years, have another child, or wait 4 years, have another child. So you're ensuring a child, and therefore your role is continuing on.
That is to say, you spread out performance. If the problem is that the woman is performing early and the man is performing late, and you can't do anything about the man performing late, you spread out the woman's performance, and you start it later. So you marry later, you have more years between children, And the other thing you do is to specialize less in being a wife. Some of it is happening automatically for the reasons I discussed before, but you still have the choice, given that your children have to have a certain amount of care, do you get a job and hire a nanny, or do you give them the care yourself? There's some shift.
If you hire a nanny, do you appreciate your value quicker?
I think you probably appreciate your value more slowly. Well, it's an interesting question.
You're not doing... I mean, I guess it depends on the person that you marry, too. Because if you marry someone who wanted a wife, and then you hire a nanny, he looks at it and goes, why did I marry her, I guess, or whatnot.
Well, she's going to help you pay for
that. But I guess it also, it all depends on the person.
Yeah, no, I think it would. But I guess I was really thinking more nearly that to the extent that if the husband is working full-time, at least with small children and no help, it's going to be pretty exhausting, at least for the first 9 months or year, and people depreciate because you've got to, you know, get no sleep and stuff like that. Yeah.
So, first question, if I understand the spreading out performance would make the husband want to reach, or not less likely to reach.
It also reduces the cost of the woman if you have three.
Right.
If she really wants to produce three children, and if the husband reaches after 4 years, she only produce one of those three children, she can produce the other two with her next husband.
Okay.
So it reduces the sub-cost.
As far as, I guess, being less specialized for the marriage, how does that affect the husband's incentive to reach? I guess it affects her incentive to reach greatly, but does it affect his so much or not so much?
Well, I guess that depends on whether the specialization is needed. If the nanny is really an adequate substitute for the wife as a child rearing, then it doesn't affect it. If it means that the child is being reared less well, then it might. So that sort of is one part of the story that at least I find interesting. And then the next step to the story is out of wedlock. And that one, I think Tom Sowell somewhere has this very depressing book, which I only read at the beginning of because I wasn't sure I disagreed with it. But it's an attack on modern liberalism. And what he's really arguing is that the purpose of modern liberalism is to let you feel good, irresponsibly. And the argument he's sketching at the beginning of it is, here are all these cases where liberals said, we should do X. It will produce good benefit Y. We did X. We got the opposite of why. And it doesn't seem to bother them. That is, obviously, it's perfectly reasonable. You could say, I believe X will do Y. I'm a well-intended person. I want Y. And I was wrong. That happens, right? It happens to everybody in lots of ways. But at least what Sowell was saying is that people don't respond to it as that. They sort of go on to their next good cause. And one of his examples, and one which is, I think, a particularly striking example, more striking to me because I'm older than you are, is that the argument for legalized abortion and the argument for making, birth control is already legal by the time I was paying attention to those things, but for making it more readily available in various forms, all of that argument, well, not all of that, a large part of that argument consisted of avoiding unwanted children. That was the standard language. So you would think that since all those things happened, unwanted children was... Replaced bastard as code word for children born out of wedlock. And you would think, therefore, the number of children born out of wedlock would decline. But, of course, it not only increased, it increased incredibly by the standards of previous life. And not just in the U.S., but after all, I think in Scandinavia now, a majority of all children are born out of wedlock. It's a little complicated by the fact that it's hard to distinguish, as the law changes, legal marriage from de facto. The impression is that a lot of the children in Scandinavia who are born to couples who are not legally married are born to couples who have been living together for a long time and expect to live together for a long time. So they may be real marriages, even not real marriages for whatever reason. But in any case, but you had exactly the opposite of that trend. And yeah, he said people were bothered by it. And he had a bunch of other examples. I don't remember. I might be right. I wonder if he's right or not. But I don't particularly like being in the position of somebody, someone else preaching to the choir when I'm the choir, and it was a depressing claim. I'd much rather believe people who disagree with me for good reasons. They just can't believe the same reasoning. Maybe I can persuade them that to say, well, they're really wicked people who pretend to be good people. That's what Sowell was saying. But going back to the question is, why did it happen? And I sketch out in the chapter what seemed to me the three most plausible reasons. reasons. And the first reason is the one that probably is most widely accepted, and that's the welfare argument. And as I suggest, that might explain some of it, but that doesn't explain why the pattern also exists in higher income groups as well as in lower income groups. And the one that I find most interesting is the one that I credit to Akerlof and Yellen. If you follow my virtual footnotes, I think I have a more detailed formal explanation of it. The Akerlof and Yellen article does the argument in terms of game theory, which as far as I know is entirely unnecessary because I can do the argument in terms of economics 100 years ago. It's just a joint cost problem. Joint costs are sort of one of the neat bits of price theory where you have a single cost that produces two products. So the classic example would be you're mining ore, of which each ton of ore produces an ounce of gold and 5 ounces of silver, say. Most of the cost is mining the ore. There's some additional cost to getting out silver and gold, but a lot of that is common, too, because you're getting everything out of the silver and gold, essentially. So then if you try to apply economics, what's the cost of producing an ounce of silver? Well, there isn't one, right? You can't separately say what's the cost of silver and what's the cost of the gold. It costs you $1,000 to produce an ounce of gold and 5 ounces of silver. That's a joint production problem. And you can then work through this sort of well-known, very straightforward economics when you figure out what the price of silver and gold be given supply and demand curves. And the situation that Akerlof and Yellen are describing is a straightforward joint production case. The joint products are babies and sexual pleasure. And those have been joint products for a very, very long time. And improved contraception, but they haven't been perfectly joint products ever, of course, because you've got coitus interruptus and forms of sex other than vaginal intercourse and so forth. So it's not like this is an absolute change of kind, but it's certainly true that it's gotten a whole lot easier over the last century or so to have just as much sexual pleasure with virtually no chance of things. Incidentally, I gather from stuff I've read that the invention of the pill was in effect deliberate social engineering. That is, that what happened was that I think one or more wealthy women went to some doctor who was dealt with reproductive matters and said, how much would it cost to develop a birth control pill? And did so because they thought the world would be a better place if women had an easy way of avoiding having children, and the cost was not horrendously high, and they provided this. One person or more that would provide a subsidy, and sure enough, it had huge effects. Whether good or bad, you can argue with it, but it's, if you think about sort of, if you're ever a billionaire or even a hundred billionaire, you may be confronted with the non-trivial question of what useful things can you do with money. And I know people who are confronted with that problem. A couple of people who are much, much, much richer than I am, who roughly share my political view, and that's pretty important to think of. And the question is, are there ways either to promote your political views or to do other good things? I mean, obviously Bill Gates has this problem. Warren Buffett has this problem. And this strikes me as an interesting example where somebody was, in fact, quite clever about finding the leverage, about saying, here is a place where $20 million, whatever it was, could change the world. And I think he's right. Then, of course, the problem with doing that is, what if it turns out to change the world to make it worse instead of better because we've miscalculated. Which I guess is a possible. You go through the Akerlof-Yellen argument, you could say, yes, and by doing that, they destroyed marriage for millions and millions of women. That's a possible reading of facts. Because what they, assuming you've already read the chapter, so I'm sort of going through it again, but what's the basic argument? It is, as long as sex and babies are joint products, women who want babies can charge for sex in the form of a guarantee of support for babies. And why can they do that? Because because their competitors face the same problem. Because other women, whether they want babies or not, know that if they have sex, they may get babies, and are therefore reluctant to have sex unless they have a promise of them. And as I mentioned in the chapter, one of the things that are interesting I discovered at some point reading up on this stuff is that somebody looked at data from several European cities in the late 19th century and did a very, very simple calculation, which is, for each couple, when were they married and when was their first child born? Well, if they are married and their first child is born 5 months later, there's a fairly obvious implication. And it turned out, contrary to sort of a lot of our views of the state, staid, you know, Victorian morality of the past, that something like a third of all brides were fetched at the altar. And that what that presumably reflected was a well-developed set of norms in which it was legitimate for a couple who were thinking of getting married to sleep together, but there was a commitment by the man that if the woman got pregnant. And part of the reason is it lets you have sex before you're willing to get married, and part of the reason is it lets the husband be sure his wife is fertile before he marries her and does not end up in a society with permanent marriage with guaranteed never to have children, which a lot of people want to have. So, but in any case, that's the issue. But then what happens once you've got good contraception and legal abortion to backstop contraceptive failures? Now, a woman who likes sex and doesn't want children can compete at low cost, in effect, against a woman who likes sex and does want children. She's willing to have sex with men on without any such guarantee, and that means that some of the women who would like to have a husband can't get one. Because, you know, the implicit in this is the argument that one reason men marry is to get sex, which at least in societies, that's true now, but in societies before you had reliable contraception, you had limited options for getting sex. Much more than now. So since the women can no longer, or at least are less likely to be able to demand those terms, some of them really want babies, and so they have babies in spite of not having husbands. And that then, sort of thinking about it that way, it occurs to me that this whole unwanted children is really a very patronizing view of the world. That it's assuming that all of those women, mostly poor women, who 50 years ago had children out of wedlock, it was all just they were incompetent, who you know, foolishly had sex and didn't bother to use a condom or something. Maybe. But there is an alternative, which is they knew perfectly well what they were doing. Maybe they were hoping that the man would marry them if they got pregnant, but maybe they were women who figured, well, you know, my mother can help me take care of the baby, and I really want to have a baby, and I can't find any husband who would marry me and who I would be willing to put up with, and therefore I'm doing this way. So the unwanted business really was a patronizing assumption, and once you drop that assumption, now it's not so surprising that the number didn't go down when people had the option of that conversation. So anyway, that struck me as sort of an interesting angle on that whole question. I don't know if anybody's actually ever really done the research to figure out whether 50 years ago, what fraction of the non-marital birth were really due to contraceptive failure. I guess one way you could do it, since abortion laws were, I am pretty sure, by state, you could ask how the rate varied when a particular state legalized abortion, which I'm pretty sure some states did, what you know, states didn't. Be a question to try to answer. So, anyway, so that provides an interesting argument. A third explanation, and this is one which I'm not sure how good the evidence is for, but sort of makes a good story, is the male-female ratio. And the argument is that the higher the ratio of men to women, the stronger the bargaining position. And this is actually becoming a future issue as well, because as you probably know, there are a number of more or less third world countries, most famously China and India, where people are pretty clearly using selective abortion to alter the gender ratio. That normally just about half the babies are male and half are female, but if you're in a society where people much prefer to have boys rather than have girls, and you have modern technology available, you use amniocentesis to tell you whether the fetus is male or female, and if it's female, you abort it. And of course, the traditional way of doing this was a somewhat more unpleasant version. The Greek version of this waited until after the baby was born, and they exposed her instead of aborting her. And so anyway, so we may well be moving to societies which have noticeably uneven gender ratios. And I remember having a conversation back when I was in Chicago Law School with a woman about the situation, and she took it for granted that the result of having more men than women would be that women would be powerless and would lose out. Because she was thinking in the context of democratic politics. I was thinking in the context of economics, which made exactly the opposite prediction, that if women are scarce, that raises their market value and increases their bargaining power on the marriage market, or the sex market, for that matter. But in any case, so the argument that is made is that because we developed modern obstetrics, in particular things like obstetricians washing their hands and using appropriate things to kill germs and such, the result was that deaths in childbirth went down a lot. I think it's pretty, somebody must have the data, but I think it's pretty clear if you read history, that until modern times, having a baby was with dangerous. The humans are badly designed to have babies, and there's a reason for this. I don't know. Basically, humans are caught in a three-way trap, and that is that human babies have big heads. The head is relatively rigid. The head has got to get out through the birth canal. The birth canal goes through the pelvis. The pelvis is rigid. So that means that you somehow have got to fit this large-headed body out of through this bony structure, and there are basically one way of doing this is to make the pelvis wider, but I gather the male pelvis is roughly optimized for running. And the reason that women don't run on average as fast as men is that a wider pelvis is mechanically less well designed for the particular job of being a bipedal running animal. So more women end up getting eaten by tigers or something if you make the pelvis too wide, although women, of course, do have wider pelvises than men, but that's a limit. Second solution is you have babies born prematurely, which all human babies are. If you compare a human baby at a month to a puppy or a kitten at a month, it's a pretty striking difference. The puppy and the kitten, they can see, they can run around, they're functioning small animals, whereas the human baby is still lying there, depending entirely on the noise. And that's basically because, relative to other mammals, human babies are born very early, and the reason they have to be is to get the head small enough. And with all of that, humans still have a lot more trouble with childbirth than a lot of other mammals do. So that means that in such societies, the number of women was being cut down by deaths in childbirth. The number of men was cut down by deaths in war, but most of the time, most men never go to war, although a few do, whereas almost all women several times have babies. Hence, the argument is that when we got modern obstetrics, the ratio of women to men went up, the bargaining power of women went down, and since many more men than women would like sex without commitment, the result would be that more women had to end up in a situation where they couldn't get out. And then the gentleman who I discussed this with, who's not a professional in the field, just an interesting, clever guy to talk with, made the further argument about what happened, by his account, in about 1960, or a little after 1960, early 60s, which is the time we associate with the sexual revolution. What's happening is that women who were born in 1946 or 47, which is the first beginning of the baby boom, are looking for men a couple of years older, and in 1944, birth rates were very low. So then the argument would be that at that point, the relevant disproportion between men and women of marriage age became very large, and therefore some women couldn't find a husband to a lover instead. Customs started changing. Now, the same story, of course, can be told pretty plausibly about black inner city populations, where what's going on is that we have an extraordinarily large number of males in jail, largely due to laws against drugs. And with a lot of males in jail, the result is a high female-male ratio. One result of that is that men who want sex don't have to get married, and one result of that is that women who want babies can't. So all of these are, I think, plausible accounts of what may explain it, and they all have the common feature that they're using the economic approach to the world to try to make sense of what people usually think of as not. And then I throw through it at the end of the discussion the one final argument, which is that as real incomes get higher, it becomes more practical for a woman to choose to bring up children without a husband, and there may well be women. There are a number of women who not unreasonably regard a husband as a net burden. They don't want to have to share their life with somebody who's got that much control over this. Line from somewhere or other about the spinster when somebody asks, you know, why she isn't married, and she says, you know, why should I marry? I've got a parent that swears, a chimney that smokes, and a cat that stays out all night. What do I need a husband for? So anyway, so all of those seem to be pretty interesting. The next bit that I discuss is coming out of another article by somebody else who I know very slightly, but a really neat article, which is Peggy Rinnick's article on glittering bonds. And that's the article on engagement rings. And that she at least argues, I think correctly, though I may be wrong, that not that engagement rings are a new custom, but that for the engagement ring to be the norm is a new custom. That of course there were sometimes people, but that she thinks it was only some point around the 30s or so that it became common that when a couple got engaged, the man was expected to provide a expensive, usually diamond ring to the woman. And her explanation of that, which is the one I like, again, I don't know if she's right or not, but it's a good story, is that this was due to the breakdown of legal constraints against seducing. If you, again, you go back to what I was saying about the late 19th century customs, there's obviously the temptation for the male who likes sex and thinks this is a really cute woman but doesn't want to get tied down to promise her anything, and then when she gets pregnant, walk off on her. And if you think about sort of human mating strategies, that's a very unattractive strategy for a woman to follow because she's stuck with the baby. For the male, there's really a trade-off. That one mating pattern is long-term mating, and that has the virtue that you've got two people bringing up the kids, so the kid's more likely to survive. But the other strategy is seduce and abandon on the ground that, yes, the kid's less likely to survive, but since you're not spending your time bringing up that kid, with luck, you can produce lots of them, and thus, since we're designed for reproductive success, you can be more reproductively successful. So humans, and males and females, but especially males, are sort of caught in the tension between those two. If you engage in a certain amount of introspection, you can see sort of in your own life how both of those patterns exist. In one sense, there's this feeling, well, that's a cute woman who I've never slept with. I want to chase her. And in a different pattern, assuming you've had long-term marital or quasi-marital relationships, this is the person who is dear to me, to whom, you know, feels like my other half, as it were. So that you really get, I think, both patterns working at once. That sort of in an odd way, sex makes a woman both more and less attractive to you. Because it's more attractive for the long-term pattern, less attractive for the short-term pattern. Anyway, so the argument in any case is that this problem existed, seduce and abandon, that the traditional solution was tort law, oddly enough, that it was tortious to promise to marry a woman and then not do it, basically. And as I suggest there, what that really was damages for loss of virginity, although it wasn't put in that language, but that was on a marriage market in which being a virgin mattered. And so the solution, Rinnick argues, it was a performance bond, namely an engagement ring. One thing I don't remember if she discussed, but would like to know whether the custom clearly was that the gilded bride kept the ring or not, because that's what her argument requires. Assuming that is the case, that then gives you a stronger incentive for keeping the contract or for not seducing the woman. If you're not willing to marry her, you're going to say something no. Anyway, so that's the Rinnick article, which struck me as a neat one. And she does have some data, not as low as you'd like, but the data do suggest that diamond imports go up at the point when states are withdrawing from enforcing damages for breach of promise to marry, and much later go down again, where the explanation then would be that we are now in a society in which seducing abandon is no longer a problem because it's sort of taken for granted that most women will have had sex before they marry. Yep. Yep.
No. Is it really? I don't know.
Is that
true, though? I think so.
The
50s was like a peak of the diamond market. That's what I said in the book.
If right? You looked up Rinnick's article, you can at least see what her data are. I read the article a long time ago. My memory is that it's in the 30s that she argues that you're getting the increase, and I don't know, 40s or 50s, somewhere around that is the peak. The imports of diamonds in the U.S. is, I think, what she had data on. You think that's unlikely?
I mean,
Yeah, you don't think they recycle the rings?
That's the other thing, though. After once you're married, the ring basically becomes a wife's property.
She can sell it.
She can definitely sell it. I'm just.
The interesting question. I wonder, people buy secondhand engagement rings? Seems sort of.
That's what I'm like.
Get the diamond set.
Yeah,
you
put
the diamond ring. You can sell the diamond ring or whatever.
Yep.
But I don't.
I'm just reporting what I remember.
I thought, when I read that, I was like, really?
I believe that I think it may be a short version of the article. I think that she has on her webpage, and I think I may have a link to it. Check on the webpage for the course. I'm not sure, but I think I may have a link. But anyway, it's called Glittering Promise. I give the name of the article in fact, I may have a link from the book webpage to it, because I'm pretty sure I did find a version, but I think not the full version of the article that she had
web. I guess my other thing, too, are just engagement rings nowadays are so lavish that it's everyone's got.
Everyone or just. Done, just
everyone. But there's a lot of people with more than a diamond in it.
Yes.
$25,000, $50,000.
These days you get the men to get it back, though, also. So that's kind of, the rules kind of changed there a little bit. My understanding is that, that you can get that back regardless of what you do.
Even if you jolted her rather than her jolting you?
Right. Even in that situation, most jurisdictions, my understanding is that you can get it back these days.
Yeah, well, I got my wife a samurai engagement ring, but then she's a geologist. Therefore, samurai is green iron. It's very pretty, but I think also lost many years ago. So. Anyway, that's the basic argument she's making. And I'll go on to the discussion next time. I'm done.
Yeah.